And Social Services Committee to order. It is now 3:31, Thursday, January 23rd in Butcherwitz 205. Members present are Senator Hughes, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Giesel, myself, Chair Dunbar, and Senator Tobin will be joining us shortly. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. This is our first meeting, so I just want to welcome everyone to Health and Social Services. A little bit of expectation setting. I like to start on time, and then hopefully we can get done. You know, if we get the work done, I'm certainly willing to end the committee early. I always say if this committee goes to 5 o'clock, that is a ceiling, not a target. For those of us who maybe haven't used this mic setup net, we have a new mic system in here. It's very sensitive. So I apologize to the folks at home. As people are getting used to it, you might hear a little more clattering. Also, we are always on. It's the reverse of how it used to be. So now you press the button to mute as opposed to press the button to go on the record. So just make sure everybody knows that. All right. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary for today, and Dennis Fukushima from the Juno LIO for staffing this committee hearing. We have one item of business on the agenda, an introductory hearing from the Department of Health. The following members of the Department of Health are here to present: Commissioner Heidi Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci, and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Bob Lawrence. Do you folks want to come forward and maybe sit down? And we've got two seats, so maybe we'll start with the commissioner and deputy commissioner, and we'll hear from you in a little bit, Dr. Lawrence. Before we begin, would you prefer the questions? Actually, you know, I think we just will do it that way. We'll have questions during, because it's a rather large, long presentation. We'll have questions during the presentation, if that's all right with you. Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else before we get started from members of the committee? All right. Seeing none. Commissioner, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation?
Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Heidi Hedberg. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Health. And with me in the galley, I just want to acknowledge that Pam Halloran is our assistant commissioner. Leah Van Kirk is my policy advisor. Betsy Woods is DC Ritchie's policy advisor. And we have Courtney Enright. I knew I was forgetting somebody. She is our legislative liaison. And so this is the leadership team. So on July 1st, we actually celebrated our second anniversary as the Department of Health. And as you look at these divisions, there has just been a tremendous amount of work in each division and across the divisions. And a lot of that work, as you look down at the bottom of this slide, what we're really focusing in on is modernizing our systems, increasing our capacity, and stabilizing our workforce, both internally and externally. And throughout this presentation, what you're going to hear is updates in those areas. What I would like to share with you, though, that is department-wide, is as a new department, we have been working diligently on a new website. And so coming soon this winter, we will be launching a new website. It is really going to be a transformation. Right now, it's currently just a repository of information, and we are going to be shifting to user journeys. So as an example, a young pregnant mom goes onto the Department of website. She goes into the search engine looking for services. If she's looking for WIC, she'll be connected in to SNAP and other program resources. A senior gets on looking for senior benefits. They'll be connected in to other programs for that senior. A healthcare provider looking to information on Medicaid will learn about how to enroll in the Medicaid program. It is going to be very transformational. That is phase one. Phase two, we will be launching our language translation. So the top five languages spoken is Spanish, Tagalog, Korean, Russian, and Hmong. That will go live. In addition to, we'll have a little chat bot so that individuals can enter their question and we'll be able to look through our website to provide information. Once we launch the website, we will, again, as we receive feedback, we'll continue to build out that website over time. Our communication team will also be working on launching an employee hub, which will be really just for our staff so that we can increase communication and really have our policies, procedures, and upcoming dates available for our employees.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Hughes.
Thank you for being here today, Commissioner. Any Alaska Native languages that'll be eventually incorporated? You mentioned Russian, Hmong, and other. Just wondering about Alaska Native languages.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Hughes, for that question. So UPIC, while we have UPIC translation services within the Division of Public Assistance, we have not been able to find a contractor that's been able to help us be able to translate all of the information on our website. So if anyone is aware of a resource, we would be happy to work with them.
Two-letter follow-up.
AI. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
Great. So as a new department, really engaging with communities, getting out, listening to Alaskan providers, clients is really important. And a lot of that work happened and continues to happen, but there was a real intention over the past 2 years. And that listening process and really identify what is working, what are the challenges, really helped us really form and shape the strategies towards implementing the Governor's Healthy Families Initiative. And so what you see on slide 3, through those conversations, it really what came and what rose up was these 4 efforts. We called them arcs of effort. So really around innovations to improving health outcomes and reducing costs. Child care, there's been a lot of discussion around child care, preventing deaths due to overdoses, suicide, and other injuries. And then really, how do we strengthen the behavioral health system? And so we are going to be providing updates on those specific efforts in addition to divisional updates in our presentation today.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, and I am the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And on slide 4, I'm going to talk a little bit about a new office in the Commissioner's office called the Office of Health Savings. And this is really a small team made up of 3 different positions within the Commissioner's office, and their focus is on achieving savings for the Medicaid program through innovation and transformation. And they really, if I think about the Office of Health Savings, their job within the department is to act as the ideas engine for the Medicaid program. So following those federal opportunities, state opportunities, leveraging those, and learning how to develop and implement those changes within the department to, again, support the Medicaid program goals, ultimately, of improving population health outcomes and value for the healthcare delivery system that we're seeing. One of the department goals is to be nimble in responding to new federal opportunities and state opportunities and leveraging more pilot projects and demonstration projects. And so this team is really tasked as providing that kind of, again, idea engine and framework for helping the divisions achieve that. The team has been fully staffed for just under a year, and in that time, they've already helped secure nearly $4 million in federal grants to support some of the technical assistance and planning for some of our key initiatives. They're essential to some of our arcs of effort, including our transformation of care arc of effort, which is on slide 5. So the transformation of care arc of effort is really focused on thinking about if the benefits and the way that we're paying for services in the Medicaid system align with the outcomes that we want to see from a health perspective in our population and a healthcare delivery perspective in building out the systems that we need to support Alaskans. So currently within this arc of effort, there's 5 main focus areas. The first focus area is a Medicaid rate methodology review project. And this started this last spring but kicked off in a public way in the fall. And through support from the Division of Insurance, the Department of Health received sufficient funding to engage a contractor and undertake a review of the rate methodologies underlying Medicaid's rates. So basically, how do we determine how Medicaid services are paid for? Again, with that perspective of, does the methodology support the outcomes that we're looking to see in the Medicaid program? As you can imagine, there's lots of different rate methodologies in the Medicaid program, so the project has been divided into 2 phases. The first phase is underway right now with recommendations due July 2025, and it focuses on Medicaid methodologies for behavioral health services, long-term care services and support, so our home and community-based waiver services, federally qualified health centers, and medical transportation. When we think about a rate methodology, there's really three different perspectives that the study is focusing on. The first is looking at the rate structure. So that includes what goes into the rates: overhead, wages, administrative costs, things like that. The second aspect is really the rate level. So how much does it pay? Are rates sufficient to cover the costs of delivering services for those providers? And then finally, we're looking at the rate policy. And so we think about the rules that are governing the rates. For example, does it make sense to require billing increments of 15 minutes for different services, or would it make more sense to look at alternative methodologies for payment, like monthly payments or capitated payments? So the rate methodology study will look at all of those aspects. We have been working closely with providers and stakeholder groups that are impacted by this throughout the process. The second area of focus.
Sorry, Deputy Commissioner, we have a question. Senator Klayman.
When you start talking about Medicaid rates, I get very interested both in Medicaid rates and Medicare rates, and I know they're different. Mm-hmm. But one of the concerns we've had in Alaska for quite a while, very specific to Medicare but also related to Medicaid, that we've been underpaying. The FMAP rates have been very low, and so that's actually made a lot of providers that refuse to actually see Medicare patients and refuse to see Medicaid patients. And in that, in the specific context of our rates are so low that providers are refusing to see the patients, is that a factor that you are building into your analysis?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. For the record, this is Emily Ricci. So just to clarify, Medicaid and Medicare, as you correctly stated, are separate programs. And Medicaid is a joint state-federal program that establishes federal match in terms of the share of the proportion of medical costs that will be covered by the state or the federal government. Medicare is an entirely federal program, so the state does not provide any funding for that. They make their own rules. Their payment rates are determined at the federal level. So we have raised the issue of Medicare rates and access to Medicare services with our federal delegation, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and really any federal administrator who has made it to Alaska to talk about that with us. So, you know, we are talking about different programs. Our rate methodology does include a look at access, but we do that from the perspective of the Medicaid rate methodology and the Medicaid rates, not necessarily the Medicare rates, which is, again, that federal program.
Follow-up? And I know it's not in this realm today, but would you be able in the future to be able to give us a meaningful analysis of where the Medicaid rates are versus what market rates are for the same services?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we can take a look at kind of what that effort would require and if we have the resources to do that.
Okay. And just a follow-up comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, my concern is that I fully support trying to figure out sensible rates, but if the rates that you're coming up with look like they're ones that still shy providers away, it seems like that rate process isn't working very well, because at some level, if we don't have a market here in the state that makes it attractive for physicians and other care providers to be in Alaska and providing the services in Alaska, we're just spending a bunch of time spinning our wheels and not helping to strengthen our economy and strengthen our access to medical care. So I know this is Medicaid, but I'm very concerned that we're underpaying Medicaid rates as well.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I don't want to slow things down, but I haven't been on this committee since the new Department of Health, and so I have a question based on the organization, because we went pretty much right into Medicaid after some overview and focus, and I see the various divisions, the five divisions, and I know Medicaid pays for behavioral health services as well as, you know, healthcare, dental. So is it kind of a separate division? Does it fall under your office? Does it have its own division? Or where does the whole Medicaid thing, does it cross over all of them? Or how do you have it set up as an organization?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes. For the record, this is Emily Ricci. So, that's a great question, because I think sometimes in the past we've thought about a single division within the Department of Health, what was formerly Health and Social Services, now the Department of Health, as being kind of the Medicaid division. But in reality, the Medicaid program spans the Division of Behavioral Health, the Division of Healthcare Services, the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and the Division of Public Assistance. So the Medicaid budget is actually a separate component in the budget. However, the Medicaid services are managed and administered in different ways through each one of those different divisions. So when we think about like the Office of Health Savings, or we think about kind of my role as Deputy Commissioner, we really oversee and touch the Medicaid program from that high-level department perspective and bring the division directors in to work collaboratively together to address Medicaid issues as they cross different divisions.
Okay, an unrelated follow-up, but it's a follow-up to Senator Klayman.
Go ahead,
it's a very
Senator,
quick, please. Short answer one. My understanding is we have trouble with providers, various types of providers, providing services to Medicare, but in the past, Medicaid was something that they were interested in. Are we also seeing some saying no to Medicaid as well as Medicare?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think it depends on the provider and the service types. It's one of the reasons that we're focusing our activities on certain provider types for phase one. These are really some of the areas where we want to make sure that we're building out capacity for those provider types, because there may be challenges in how Medicaid is reimbursing them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I have been waiting with bated breath to hear about phase two. So you can continue.
For the record, Emily Ricci, the next focus area of the transformation of care effort is the Medicaid demonstration projects. And I know we'll spend a lot of time talking about that during our next committee hearing, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that today. But that includes opportunities for the state to kind of think about newer, innovative ways to provide Medicaid benefits and coverage. And we have our Office of Health Savings team, again, working closely with the different divisions to leverage and build out some of those opportunities. And I just want to thank the legislature and committee members for your support last year in passing key legislation to give us the opportunity to build that out. The next area of focus in the transformation of care is school-based services. And again, I want to thank the committee and the legislature for your support in helping us remove some of the statutory barriers so that we can really provide services to our children in the setting where they spend the most time. So last year, I think we mentioned to the legislature that we were pursuing a grant for about $2.5 million from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to build these out. We were awarded that grant, and we are currently working with a contractor that speaks both school district language and Medicaid language so that we can begin to bridge the two and build this out. So that work is underway in earnest. Two other items that I want to touch on really briefly involve some new areas of focus for us. There were requirements by the federal government that passed about 2 years ago and took effect January 1st of this year, focused on providing services for justice-involved youth 30 days before release. So these services include screening services, care coordination, and case management. And this is notable because it was a little bit of a new way to think about connecting Medicaid and health insurance with the juvenile or the youth before they leave the carceral setting, again, to provide that care coordination. I'm pleased to announce that we also received notice just 2 weeks ago of a $1.6 million award from CMS to help us build out these systems. And other states in the U.S. are kind of struggling to get up to speed and to offer these services. And so we're actually viewed as one of the states that is kind of on the forefront of being prepared to offer this. And I really credit that to the cross-collaboration between the Department of Health, the Department of Family and Community Services, through the Division of Juvenile Justice, and the Department of Corrections. I think the work in that area will lead us, will really inform some of the ongoing work for that fifth area focus, which is reentry supports. That is more focused on federal opportunities that make available certain screening and care coordination activities for adults who are in an incarceral setting within 90 days of discharge. So again, I think we'll talk more about that next week, but those are our five areas of immediate focus for this arc of effort.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner. So, again, one of our arcs of effort is child care. And recognizing the importance of child care, the governor created a task force on child care. That work culminated this fall. The task force had a lot of robust conversations. Senator Tobin was on that task force. Two reports were created. With those two reports, there were 56 recommendations of those 56 recommendations, 13 recommendations have been implemented, and 21 recommendations are currently underway. What I want to highlight for you is a couple of those areas of focus for the coming year. So this fall, we launched a new Alaska child care information system. It is a database with three portals, one for parents requesting subsidies, one for child care providers with licensing, and for our staff. It was launched internally, and soon in the coming months, it will be launched out to our parents and to our providers. The second area around streamlining is that we will be initiating a pilot project. This is really to increase that accessibility and the reliability of and decreasing that processing time for background checks. So we purchased a live scan fingerprinting equipment. We're in the process of purchasing. We're going to deploy that out to four rural communities and pilot this process really with the goal that we are able to background check these child care workers in a more expedited fashion. Once we work out the logistics and the operations, we do see this as an opportunity to expand to other provider types that need to go through that background check. But we are starting small. This was a recommendation out of the task force. The next is expanding licensing options. So what part of the task force was looking within Alaska on recommendations, we also looked to the lower 48. And what we are seeing, some of the states have created a new license type that is called Friends, Families, and Neighbors. This is a new license type. And the best scenario that I can provide for you is in many of our communities, we do not have licensed child care. There is a licensed child care desert. And so these families who qualify for a subsidy, they cannot use that subsidy because there's nobody that is licensed. By creating this license type for friends, families, and neighbors, individuals this family knows, they meet the same health and safety standards. They go through that process, and then that family can use that subsidy to pay for child care. When we look at Alaskan families that would qualify for a subsidy, only about 20% are actually taking advantage of the subsidy. And so this is one of these areas that we are going to be exploring and building out with our partners so that we can increase access to childcare and for families that qualify for a subsidy. The next area is around workforce. There's been a lot of conversation around childcare workforce. And so I want to draw your attention, and I know this is a policy conversation, but in the budget, I would like to just note that there are two PCNs. One of those PCNs is really going to be focusing on the business sector and providing technical assistance to the business sector. What we heard loud and clear through the task force conversations was businesses need employees, they need workers, and there are people that want to work, but they don't have access to childcare. And the businesses are looking at opportunities, and so this person will really be that liaison to bring the childcare sector, the business sector together so that businesses can build out on-site or near-site childcare as an example. So we're really looking forward to that position passing and filling that position. The second area is that we will be, one of the recommendations was to conduct a study looking at vacant state buildings and or school classrooms or school buildings that could be used for child care. When the cost of care study was completed, one of the top drivers for cost was really rental fees for these facilities. And so this is a way to drive down those costs. So as the child care provider, that employer that is operating child care, they can use this partnership with a school as an example, or maybe a state building, have the revenue coming in. It's possible they could pass that revenue to their employees, increasing their wages as an example. So really looking at some of those areas. Ensuring quality care, there were many recommendations. One of those recommendations that we will be actioning is leveraging our preschool development grant. It's a federal grant, and we will be hiring some support to have coaching and consultation to child care providers to help them in gaining the tools and understanding on how to manage children who have behavioral health needs that are really being disruptive in that child care setting. What we heard through our workforce meetings was that there is some turnover because child care workers have children with behavioral health needs and they don't know how to manage it. And so we're really connecting in the child care provider with behavioral health support in order to teach those tools. And then finally, improving accessibility and affordability. Through, again, the preschool development grant, we'll be offering some startup funds for Alaskans that want to open up a child care center. And we will be looking at what is known as a geographical income difference. So currently, right now, in child care subsidies, there is a geographical difference. Income, there is not. So when you look at all of the families, the income is exactly the same. So if you're in a rural community, you have higher income because there's a higher cost of living, but you are priced out because your income is too high. You do not qualify for a subsidy. So we will be looking at a geographical income differential so that we can equalize and allow families that would otherwise qualify for a subsidy to allow them to, the opportunity to qualify and take care of that income difference.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really appreciate the report out. I do recommend folks, if they have a chance, to read all of those recommendations. And I also want to draw attention to the 2023 market price survey report, which I think some of this work is based on. And it was very helpful to see the geographic costs of childcare very clearly delineated so that we can help serve families. But I do want to make one point and note, and that it's mostly for my education community, in that the ability to redirect these preschool development dollars is really because of the Alaska Reads Act, because we did dedicate funds to help school districts develop their school-based pre-K programs in a different budget allocation. So I just want to make sure folks are aware that we're not actually detracting from school districts being able to provide high-quality pre-K.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Senator Hughes.
And while the topic of education is up, I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I don't want to open the door to something, a tough discussion on education, but in looking at the number of contact hours for students in our K-12 schools, we're a lot less because of the days of year and the number of hours. And for like kindergarten through fourth, fifth grade, that can affect people needing before and after school. And when you look at Alaska, I think it's compared to Texas, by the time a child graduates from high school, K through 12, they've actually had equivalent to almost three more years, which is unbelievable, of school years of contact time. So, and as we're trying to address, academic outcomes in K-12, that's something that we could consider that actually would help the child care situation, if you had started maybe a little bit earlier, shifted a little longer, how you ever did it, or maybe a few more days tacked on here and there. And I know that's a tough conversation to have, but was that part of the task force discussion, is even the length of the school day and how that could maybe help address this shortage and problem?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, no, the task force was really focusing on zero to kindergarten age. That was the age group.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Commissioner. We can continue to the next slide.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Dr. Robert Lawrence, Chief Medical Officer for Alaska's Department of Health. It's a pleasure to see each of you. It's my job to present our third arc of effort. And so if you're following the different arcs, we've talked about the first arc, transformation of care. Second arc was child care. And now I'll introduce this arc, which is overdose and suicide prevention. It's a sad reality that we continue to see a large number of deaths from overdose and suicide. And so that's why you see this being elevated by the department as an arc of effort. thanks to legislation and hard work done by you and the legislature last year, we were able to pass legislation that authorized me as chief medical officer to help set up medical review committees. And one of those review committees is the Opioid Fatality Review Committee. And that committee is meeting even this month, so that is now underway. And those committees will be tasked with three basic things. The first is to review de-identified case reports of each of these deaths. Second is, from those reviews, come up with meaningful, actionable recommendations for changes that can be made at the community level or changes to policy. And then third is to make sure that those recommendations are getting back into the hands of those who can make the difference. And so that's how the medical review committees will work. Now, that work is being done in parallel with work across the state in a whole government effort in what we call the Alaska Opioid Response. And so imagine work being done in each of the different departments, particularly the Department of Health, but also Department of Family and Community Services, as well as DOC and DPS and the Department of Law and the Mental Health Trust Authority, all working together in five key areas of intervention. And you see those on the slide. The first of those areas is interdiction, which is basically asking, how do we prevent drugs from getting into our state? And that leads into the second, which is prevention. If drugs do get into our communities, what do we do to prevent those from getting into the hands of those who are at risk? And if the drugs do get into the hands of people who are at risk, we move on to harm reduction, which is asking, what can we do to prevent those who are at risk, who have access to drugs, from dying from this access? So this brings to mind things like what we're doing to provide Narcan or what we're doing to treat hepatitis C, things that would be associated with deaths associated with opiates. But we don't stop there. That, of course, leads to treatment and connecting people to treatment. And then we don't stop with treatment. That, of course, leads to recovery efforts and lifelong recovery. What I hope would come to mind here is that you see that these are not separate efforts done by separate departments in different areas. These are actually interventions and efforts that are all woven together. And so we call these five cords of intervention to bring to mind this idea that all of this work across the state is being woven together into what we say a rope to pull people back to freedom. Now, that work being done obviously has to be funded, and part of the funding for this work ties into the settlement dollars that have come back into the state from the National Opioid Settlement. And so those monies now, when they come into the state, are evaluated and distributed. This last year, the monies were distributed to 18 different communities across the state, and one statewide organization that helps distribute funds further to organizations that just were not large enough to submit an application for their own grant. But I think the main take-home point there is that the settlement dollars, or at least 80% of those dollars, are making their way back into our communities. So that's a snapshot of what's being done on the overdose front. Most of my comments are focused on what we're doing in terms of preventing overdose, but if you would imagine, there's similar parallel work being done to prevent suicides in the state as well in ways that are very similar.
Senator, actually, I'm going to ask a question, and I'll get to you, Senator Claim, if I could. You don't have it here, and perhaps you don't have it sort of top of mind, but how are we doing now relative to years past on either overdoses or suicides? That is, the trends that you are seeing. Do we generally have more suicides now than we did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and same with overdose? Those deaths? You know, I know there was a spike in recent years. Has that started to come back down? Do you have any sense of those kind of trends?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. It's actually a great question. I would say if we could split the two, in terms of overdose deaths, we're not seeing a major change. There was a spike in the last few years. So in 2023, we saw that rise of well over 40% compared to the previous year. It looks like, and this is all preliminary data, so take this with a grain of salt, but the preliminary data shows that in 2024, we'll probably end up seeing the same level of overdose deaths that we saw in 2023. So we'll follow up with you once that data is finalized. When it comes to suicide deaths, there has not been a change. There still seems to be about the same number of suicides from year to year, and that actually goes back over the last several years. So unlike overdose deaths, there was not a spike, and then we see a change. So still a lot of work to do on both fronts.
Just a follow-up. So that's sort of the last few years. Do you have a sense of where we are relative to 20 years ago or 40 years ago? You know, when I was a young person growing up in Alaska, suicide was top of mind then too. You know, I grew up in rural Alaska. It was ever present. And so I am sort of curious, what progress, if any, have we made, or have we lost ground since, let's say, 20 years ago? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. I don't have those numbers, but like you, I share that curiosity, and so that's something we'd be happy to bring to you.
Thank you. Senator Klayman?
It's on the same area. I understand, although on a national level, we've seen some improvements in some of the numbers. Alaska has not followed the national trend. Any thoughts on why Alaska hasn't, why we haven't done better, and why we're not seeing some of the reductions we're seeing nationally, which I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's both on the suicide numbers and the overdose numbers.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, thank you for that question. The answer is that it's multifactorial in terms of why Alaska is seeing the rise. We have moved kind of slowly up the scale to be number two and in some cases number one in some factors, and that's not something we're proud of. I think one of the factors to keep in mind is that Alaska, as in many things that related to healthcare that seemed to move across the country, we were a little late coming into the opioid crisis in terms of the spike in our numbers, and so it makes sense that our numbers are now at a peak, whereas our colleagues maybe in the lower 48 are seeing those numbers fall. Mm-hmm. But that's only one factor.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I was just hearing that from some school principals that they provide resources when there's need, particularly for teenagers, for mental health. And they'll give a list of resources, and they get feedback from parents that there's a four-month waiting list to get them in. So is there an effort or recommendation related to increasing our workforce for mental health in our communities? And I imagine it's probably worse in other communities than it is in my area. So is there work being done on that to make sure we have enough providers?
Through the chair, can I defer to our commissioner?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner, through the chair, thank you, Senator Hughes. We're actually going to answer that question in our fourth arc of effort, which is strengthening the behavioral health system.
Yeah, I was going to say that was a good segue, I think. If we want to go to the next slide.
So our fourth arc of effort is really around strengthening the behavioral health system for youth. And what we saw coming out of the pandemic, I heard a lot of stories from parents about the mental health toll that it took on their children. And it was also reflected in our data, and we are seeing that adolescents are at an all-time high of needing mental health resources. I want to point out Alaska is not alone. I think every state is facing this issue. The question is, how is Alaska responding to this issue? And so the Department of Health, the Department of Family and Community Services, and in partnership with our tribes, we all came together, and there was really a very intentional focus for an 8-month period of time where collectively we went out together to 5 regions across the state. During the day, we had a lot of conversations and listening from providers and from parents and Alaskans on what were the challenges to accessing community-based services and what were the solutions, what were their solutions that they had identified. In addition to those 5 regions, we also did a statewide virtual event, and then we had a specific session for our behavioral health aides. That was a lot of rich information that came to us. And, you know, part of this process was, A, creating a shared goal around youth behavioral health services. 2 was recognizing the geographical difference, that there isn't going to be one solution fits all, but we need to recognize that we need to create the flexibility and have departments be nimble, which is part of our transformation of care process. And 3, when we collected all of that information on the screen, what you can see is there's a continuum of care. And so it starts from that prevention, early intervention, outpatient services, crisis and subacute services to that residential and step-down services. That was really the continuum of care. And underneath that cross-cutting was really the data integrations, the provider supports, and care coordination. that collective work really came together to 47 recommendations across these areas, but more importantly, very specific identified next steps, actionable next steps for those 47 recommendations. We have already, we are actively underway, both the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services, working on 21 of those recommendations. So again, taking a step back, 2 years ago is really in that listening posture, identifying what were the changes that needed to happen specific within the Department of Health. And what you're going to start to see over the next 2 years is a lot of the implementation of these system changes so that we can increase access to services according to this continuum of care. I want to pause and just reflect that this work was intentional. It was specific and collaborative with our tribal partners, and it was also recognized by the Department of Justice. So 2 years ago, the state of Alaska received a report on the unnecessary institutionalization of children. And it was a very, very concerning report. And so we have been in conversations with the Department of Justice over the past 2 years as they continue to interview Alaskans across the state. What I'd like to share with you is an update to that. Last week, we signed a letter of agreement between the Department of Justice and the state of Alaska. What that means is that the Department of Justice is not going to sue the state of Alaska for 3 years. And in exchange, we are going to continue to provide updates on the work that we are doing in this area. It is not solely just focused on the youth behavioral health roadmap and those recommendations. It is part of that work. But I think that the Department of Justice has recognized that we are meaningfully working towards change, and we are progressing through this process, and we will continue. The case is still under investigation. It is still open, and we're going to continue to work through this process.
Commissioner, before you go on, can you give us sort of a practical example of those kind of changes? So, you know, the 21 that you've implemented, what does it actually mean for someone that might be listening? Like, what kind of changes?
Thank you, Chair. I'm actually going to defer that question to DC Ritchie, and she can talk about the transition of claims.
Sure. For the record, Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and Chairman. Some of the immediate things that we heard were foundational to the behavioral health system. So while they're reflected in the Youth Behavioral Health Roadmap, we also heard about them as challenges from behavioral health providers in general. So understanding that the Medicaid program is a significant payer for behavioral health claims, kind of the three large things that we heard from providers when we came in, from my perspective, is one, thinking about that rate methodology review, right? Are we paying the correct rate for the outcomes that we want to see, and is the methodology and how we're paying aligning with that? The second is, are we paying claims timely and accurately? Are systems working effectively? And we heard there were challenges there. And then the third was administrative burden. You know, can we make it easier for providers to focus on their work versus trying to figure out how to bill Medicaid? And so we've made meaningful steps, I think, in all three of those areas. We talked about the rate methodology review that is underway right now, and really the first group we focused on with that is our behavioral health providers. The second area of work, and it's one line in our presentation, but it represents a tremendous volume of work, is actually transitioning claims from an admin service organization into the Medicaid, standard Medicaid claim system that is used by all other claims. That transition took effect November 1. So it has already happened. Behavioral health claims are now being paid out of kind of that standard Medicaid system, and we're in the stabilization period. Our focus for 2025 with the division is going to be building out those provider supports. So those are just some I think, primary examples of some of what we heard in the behavioral health roadmap and some of the work that's been underway to begin addressing those immediately.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Commissioner, I think I interrupted you right before complex care, if you want to work on that.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dunbar. What I also wanted to just mention, and I want to underscore, is with this letter of agreement, it does not mean that the department is done with its work. It means that there's progress that is being made, and there's still a lot of work to do in building out and implementing many of these strategies. I also want to reflect in what have we done. School-based services is one of those recommendations in the Youth Behavioral Health Roadmap. We are using it as part of the transformation of care. Everything that we talk about is very much intertwined. And so complex care, I'm actually going to defer to DC Ritchie, and she will provide an update on this specific work.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. And when we think about complex care, you know, we think about really a subset of individuals that have very highly complex needs and engage with the system in a complex manner, hence the term complex care. Typically, when we see these individuals, they have some combination of severe behavioral health diagnoses, potentially a developmental disability, and complex medical needs. And so they're accessing programs from the state that cross divisions, sections, and even departments. And so part of the work that we've been focused on is really to help organize ourselves so that we can meet the needs of the individual, not asking them to try to meet our needs in our organizational structures. So in the last probably 2 years since we started, we stood up something called case review teams. These are teams that meet weekly, and the teams are actually organized out of the Department of Family and Community Services and the Commissioner's Office. So they work jointly with the Department of Health, and we review on a weekly basis individuals that are brought to the complex case review team that meet this criteria. And we're coming together across different divisions and departments to review the person's need and to identify how we can kind of make sure that our programs and our systems are effectively meeting their need. At the same time, we have monthly complex care coordination meetings, committee meetings. And those meetings kind of take things up to a higher level. And so it tends to be leadership from different divisions or sections talking about the trends that we're seeing with some of these complex cases on the individual level, and then identifying gaps in our programs and potential solutions to fill those. So some of that work has actually resulted in changes through some of the waivers that the Division of Senior and Disability Services has undertaken. Those have just taken effect, and they really provide some more flexibility for acuity rates for providers who are serving these populations, additional options for supplemental staffing as well to support those, new placement options for youth and adolescents, and eventually the build-out of a specialized family habilitation home that would be created to specifically serve some of these needs. So that's just an example of how we're trying to approach these problems from both an individual perspective and then feeding that into a systems solutions.
Thank you.
For the record, Heidi Hecker, Commissioner. So slide 8, we are now going to transition from our major arcs of effort. Again, these arcs of effort are taking all of our divisions, and some of them are engaging with the Department of Family and Community Services and many other departments. It's really a collective approach. We are now going to provide just very brief updates on each of the divisions within the Department of Health.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and moving on to slide 10. Going to provide kind of a highlight of some of the kind of key achievements of the division last year and what we're focusing on moving into 2025. And so thinking about the division and our focus on strengthening the behavioral health system, the Division of Behavioral Health Services is really core to that effort. And so, again, I think we'll talk about 1115 demonstrations more next week, but it's important to just recognize that the current 1115 demonstration waiver that Alaska has is focused on behavioral health care and has now formed kind of foundational services for the behavioral health community in Alaska. Demonstration waivers are typically 5 years long, and so at the end of 5 years, the waivers must be renewed and approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It's actually quite a lengthy process and requires substantial effort. So our behavioral health waiver, the demonstration period ended in December of 2023, and we received approval to extend that for another five-year period this year in March of 2024.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. That renewal, can it continue indefinitely? That is there a limited number of times that we can realistically apply for this waiver? And I ask because it does sound like, and through the work I think a lot of us have done, it's increasingly becoming sort of, like as you said, foundational to the system in Alaska. And so were it to go away, it would be, catastrophic. I don't know what the right word would be, but is there any sort of reason that it would go away any time in the foreseeable future?
To the chair, we don't foresee it going away in the future, but I think the question is what comes next, right? This was the first 1115 waiver that the state of Alaska applied for and engaged in. And so many other states use 1115 waivers more widely, and they tend to have kind of broader subset of services within the 1115 waiver. Ours right now is focused on behavioral health reform, but many states leverage them for other things. One state, I believe Arizona, their entire Medicaid program is actually offered through an 1115 waiver. So they are very, very flexible. I think as we look forward into what comes next, we're really beginning to ask, what amendments do we need to make to the demonstration waiver, right? So what is working? What is not working? Do we need to make any changes? And then also, is it appropriate for any of these services to move from the 1115 waiver into the state plan? And it's really technical, so I don't want to get too much into it, but there's considerations there. So that's kind of the next phase for the 1115 waiver.
Thank you. Senator Klayman.
On that same topic, it sounds like you're not worried that the demonstration project would go away, but in 5 years, are we going to need to renew again?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we will need to renew every 5 years. Okay. And in between that time period, and again, I think we'll talk more about this next week, there's significant reporting that occurs on a consistent basis. So it takes quite a lot of effort to maintain these.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Klayman.
So another area of focus for us is crisis services. We want to continue to build out this aspect of the continuum of care. We know that there remain gaps. It's hard to stand new services up. And so this year we focused on bringing in a consultant, Milliman, to look at our crisis services system, what our goals were, where we're at now, and to provide recommendations for areas of focus next year to continue to strengthen that. So you'll see in our 2025 focus, that's going to be a focus area of ours. We are also leveraging the rate methodology review to meet with some of the different providers who have been focused on standing up these crisis stabilization services so that we understand kind of what they thought the financial picture would look like, what it is now, and that we're taking that into consideration as we think about building out crisis stabilization services and rates.
Senator Klayman.
Both in the context of crisis stabilization and crisis residential, which has been the subject of legislation that Senator Giesel and I have both been involved with. Do you foresee any need for additional legislation that would make it possible to continue to provide the services that you're looking to provide, or have what we passed so far what you need at the present time? And I know you were very available, but I just wanted to know on that horizon, do you see currently additional legislation needed?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, at this time we do not foresee a need for additional legislation for crisis services. We are currently working through a very large regulations project, and so we're kind of in that implementation and operational stage. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to ask a question that I've asked previously the department, as I've heard from many of our partners, that they are struggling with capital needs. And so I'm curious, as part of this assessment, was that a question that was asked to our partners? And is there a discussion about what those needs are and how we might be able to provide that support to them?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, we are aware of the request for capital needs. I am not certain if that was included in the assessment. I will need to take a look and get back to you and follow up with you on that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So looking at the last portion of the operational update for 2024, again, we talked about implementation of the transition for transitioning behavioral health claims into kind of the main Medicaid system. We believe that that's gone well. It has not gone perfect. We're looking at over $300 million in claims that were paid out of that system to nearly 15,000 providers, or Alaskans, excuse me. And so a transition of that size is always, you think you know what you know when you go into it, and you learn a lot the day after you transition about what you didn't know. However, at this point, I think we are through the majority of that stabilization period, but we're going to continue to stabilize that transition as a primary focus over the next few months. We're also focused on building out provider supports, and we are currently in a procurement process for that. We're focusing again on developing sustainable crisis services. And then an area that I'm very excited about is we're focused on certified community behavioral health clinics. So certified behavioral health clinics provide coordinated and comprehensive mental health and substance use disorder services. And there's certain requirements to be a certified community behavioral health clinic that kind of distinguish the delivery of this care and the organization of that care from other types of clinics. So in Alaska, we have four entities that are basically organized as certified community behavioral health clinics. One of the benefits to being those clinics is you can receive different types of payments from federal programs. So for example, Medicaid programs can provide an enhanced type of payment, almost like an encounter rate, to these clinics. In order for that to occur, however, the Medicaid program has to establish its certification process, its regulations, its rate methodology, all of that work. And so we just learned, I think in the last 2 weeks, that we applied for and received $1 million grant from the federal government to be part of the next cohort of states that are engaging in the planning and design for these types of community behavioral health clinics. So we are starting that work now. We are excited for that. The planning period should wrap up by the end of this calendar year, and then we will move into the implementation period through a demonstration project. So we will have to apply to be part of that next cohort of demonstration projects, but this is good news for us moving forward in this direction.
Hey, Senator Hughes.
Is this similar to what HRSA administers as far as the FQHCs for the medical, but it's going to be behavioral kind of thing where they can't turn people away and that kind of thing? Even uninsured low income would have access. And is it a similar model?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, it is similar in many ways.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Please proceed, Deputy Commissioner.
So moving on to slide 11, if we kind of think about the Office of Healthcare Savings, Office of Health Savings as kind of the idea engine for the Medicaid program in the department, I think about the Division of Healthcare Services as the heart of the Medicaid program, kind of pumping blood through the system. The Division of Healthcare Services is responsible for the claims payment, adjudication, and processing of all the claims in the Medicaid system. So it's quite a lot of work. That equates to about 8.5 million claims processed annually to nearly 30,000 Medicaid providers and an average of $52 million in weekly check writes. So it's really important that this program and these processes and operations move forward consistently. So one of our key focus areas for 2024 was really increased operational capacity. For the prior fiscal year, we saw very, very high vacancy rates in that division combined with generational turnover. So we were seeing vacancy rates averaging between 29 and 31%. We're happy to announce that as of December this year, that vacancy rate factor has dropped to 12%, and we've really been focused on providing some of the support and training to division employees to make sure that they have the tools that they need to be successful and effective in their work. At the same time, we've also identified through that work solutions to improve operations, kind of short and medium-term solutions to address some of the feedback that we get from providers in terms of their ability to interact with our system. That developed into a Medicaid systems modernization plan. We'll talk about that more in the next slide, but our focus in 2025 is going to be to implement that plan, and it is really kind of shifting from a model where in order to see any system updates, you had to kind of replace the system in its entirety, which was high risk and high effort. And what we're looking at doing is leveraging kind of modules to replace certain aspects of the system so that we are able to see improvements faster and at a lower risk. So examples of that would be the implementation of a provider enrollment portal, which is currently included in the governor's capital budget. This would allow providers to upload all of their documentation for their enrollment packet through a self-service portal. They would be able to see the status of their application, and we would be able to leverage automation to kind of do some of the checks that occur manually now by people through that, and then either approve or disapprove that enrollment faster. So we're looking at doing that for a number of our different services. Next year, we're also focused on improving quality assurance frameworks, so just making sure that we have the framework in place at a division level to focus on high contractual service and customer service, and then we're continuing to focus on developing our workforce capacity. So moving on to slide 12, we talked a little bit about the Medicaid modernization, and we spent a lot of time in prior committee hearings talking about the Division of Public Assistance and some of the challenges that they experience with their older systems. I think when we look at the Division of Healthcare Services, we see some analogous challenges in terms of having systems that are that still require a lot of manual intervention from people doing things, clicking on things, finding emails, matching up attachments. And we think that it's going to be important for our staff and for our system to really move away from that and leverage automation and new systems as much as possible. So in the short term, we're focused on using smart forms to kind of help address some of the immediate challenges we're seeing in areas like provider enrollment and service authorizations. However, medium to long term, we're looking at implementing those self-service portals that should provide more support for our providers and our staff. We are also looking at rolling out a patient mobile app that should come out later this year. Initially, that will give people access to their Medicaid ID card on their phone, but over time, we'll be able to build that out so they will have access to claims information and other information as well.
So last year, and the next slide is DPA, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about with SNAP and whatnot, but there was this huge backlog, obviously, 2 years ago. And then moving into last year, there was this worry that a similar backlog would emerge in Medicaid with, I think it was re-enrollments, or there was specific issues that we were worried about. I haven't seen any headlines about it, so can you sort of provide an update? Are we through that period of risk, or are we still worried about a large backlog developing there as well?
Through the chair, we are still working through the Medicaid redetermination process. However, we are at the very tail end. So in 2023, April of 2023, all states had to undertake a process of redetermining Medicaid eligibility for all members. That had been suspended during the federal public health emergency. There were also requirements that state implement new systems and new standards to try to automate some of that process. It was a very, very heavy lift for states across the nation, including Alaska. In September of this year, we finished initiating all of the redeterminations for Medicaid enrollees for that period. And now there were certain redetermination applications that were suspended while we made some system changes and updates. We are now working through the last of those. I think there's about 17,000 that are outstanding, and we should wrap up those processing those by March. So we're in the tail end of that effort. And once we finish that redetermination, that annual review and redetermination will occur kind of organically.
Thank you. Senator Tobin?
I'll ask after.
Okay. Please proceed.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner. So I'm going to present on the next three slides, and they are about the Division of Public Assistance. I think that there's a lot of conversations. So first I want to talk about the operational updates, then the focus for 2025, and the last slide is really going to be IT focus. I think it's helpful to really look at when we talk about modernization, what are we talking about? So on slide 13, we are really focusing on simplifying the engagement and, again, improving our operational efficiency. And so this is work that has already undertaken. So we launched an online client portal. It is called Alaska Connect Portal. So Alaskans will connect through My Alaska, and they are able to log in and apply for any of the public assistance programs, renew their benefits, report any change status to us, and that is also a portal that is secure for them to upload their supporting documentation. So that went live, and that is going well. In addition, we worked with USDA, and we received approval for what is called the Elderly Simplified Assistance Project, also known as ESAP, and that was implemented on December 1st of 2024. The elderly simplified population are adults that are age 60 or older and in the household and have a disability as defined by Food Nutrition Services. So their certification period was 24 months and it extended to 36 months. They do not have to provide an interim report during that certification period, and no interview is required unless they want to conduct an interview. And I think the benefit to that client is that they have that continuity of that benefit that they need. In addition, it really meters out all of these renewals by extending that certification for this population. When we look at our SNAP case, our households, that's 41% of our SNAP. So that's pretty significant to move them from that 24-month to that 36-month. And that went live again on December 1st. And then we have also engaged in text messaging. It has been an incredibly helpful tool to remind clients that we'll be reaching out to them to conduct their interview. And because of that, we're seeing a 61% rate of answer, which is fantastic. And then we also remind Medicaid clients to renew their applications via text. Improving operations, March 2023, we were very much at a low point. We were at a 28% timeliness for completing an application. Over that period of time has just been a lot of progress. And so this month, January of 2025, our average for SNAP is 71%. Our goal that we are working towards is 95%, which is the national standard, is 95%. So you can see that, again, there's just been a lot of progress over time. And I really want to thank the eligibility technicians and the staff within the Division of Public Assistance. They've really been working hard. And there's just been a lot of change that they've had to adapt to, and they've done well. In addition, as a reminder, during the federal public health emergency, USDA had waived all of those SNAP interviews. There was also a period of time when we shut down all of our offices and staff worked remotely. What we found is it's really easy to move into a remote environment. It was much more difficult to reopen the offices. Part of that is because of our staff turnover. And so it took us much longer to open up our offices. And so what I want to acknowledge is that, first and foremost, that we are in full compliance with SNAP interviews. I do go to the offices, I talk with staff, and I hear from staff that they really do like connecting with their clients and doing the interviews. And then the clients really like to have that FaceTime. So that's good news. Second, all of our offices are open. And what that means is that a client can walk into a public assistance office today, that they can complete an application. If an interview is required, they can complete that interview. And if they qualify, they can receive those benefits. And so I think that is just really important to highlight that we have same-day service now for our public assistance offices.
Senator Klayman.
Same day is great. It's super good news. I'm often asked about the same question about people that would sometimes go to the emergency room for care, and it's the same day, but the same day could be a darn long day. What does same day look like if somebody walked into a Division of Public Assistance today? Does that mean they better plan on a whole day, or is it faster than that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Klayman, that's a great question. At the University Center, I will say that when I am there visiting, there is a long line and that they do wait. In more of our rural communities, when I visited down on the Kenai Peninsula and went to Kenai and Homer, there was maybe one or two people. So I think it really depends on the time of day and the size of the office. So the next slide 14, is really the focus for the upcoming year with the Division of Public Assistance. Really at the heart of our efforts is two key priorities. One is enhancing our customer service, and two is really fostering our employee engagement. And so last year, the division implemented a continuous quality improvement process. Really what that means is when errors are identified, there's a root cause analysis, whether it's through training, whether it's through policy changes or an IT system, it's corrected. So we have a mechanism to track this process, and that is continuing. The second, as DC Ritchie mentioned, we are finalizing Medicaid redeterminations that will be completed in March. The third is just a reminder that the Child Care Program Office is within the Division of Public Assistance, and I've talked a lot about the work that's happening within the Child Care Program Office. And then finally, it's just there's a significant amount of work by a small but mighty team in the Division of Public Assistance that works on our IT modernization. And that brings us to slide 15. So, you know, I think it's really helpful when we talk about the modernization of our system that we really break it down. And so last year, what some of you heard me provide an update was that we moved our ARIES system and our document management system from a mainframe into the cloud, and it's secure. And that was specific and really intentional because that move really provided the future for advancements by aligning the updates to our technology infrastructure. We needed to get it into the cloud. We have been working really diligently on RFPs, and so this year we will be issuing two RFPs. The first is to migrate our non-MAGI categories off the mainframe. That will be going out very soon. The second is an RFP to migrate the SNAP off of the mainframe. Once those contractors are selected, they're going to begin that work. And once those programs are off of the mainframe, then we'll follow up with migrating TANF and the cash programs. You can see on this slide, the time frame is still 2028. The project management office continues to meet these milestones, and we continue to stay on track. The second area I want to talk about is just that enhancing the client engagement. So I've talked about text messaging, the secure portal. There's a second phase to the Alaska Client Connect, and I think this is really going to benefit the clients because they're going to be able to get information on their case much quicker instead of waiting online through the VCC, the Virtual Contact Center. And so the second phase of the Alaska Connect portal will be they can review and update their demographics, so their address as an example, which will be really helpful. The second is they'll be able to review all of the notices that we send. They'll be able to see an application status. So if it's pending, they'll know we're waiting on supporting documentation, and that can be the trigger for them to follow through in submitting that documentation. And then we will also be we're in the process of developing a multi-application, which for all programs, and it's a smart form. So it really goes through, and if somebody is eligible and they're qualified, instead of completing different applications. And then finally, a calendar of events so that clients know when their benefits need to be renewed, what their benefits amounts are, and when their interview dates are. And so I think it's really going to help the clients to really to have access to that information pretty quickly, and that will roll out in 2025. Operational efficiencies, again, the two check marks mean that they have already been completed. DC Ritchie talked about Medicaid and the ex parte process, so with updated information, we now have connections with the databases to automatically review and renew if they're still qualified. In November, we launched something called Advanced Capture. And so the division receives a significant amount of emails, and those emails will have applications, they'll have questions, they'll have renewal forms. Advanced Capture identifies those applications or renewals, pulls it out of the email, and puts it into the workflow management system so an eligibility technician can process that. That's really helpful for the clerical staff. It decreases their workload. It's also helpful to ensuring that we are not losing those documents. So we're excited to see how that really helps with our staffing and the document management. The next three, our clerical staff have a the document management system that they're uploading documents or managing documents. And our eligibility technicians are working in the workflow management system. And the two systems are not connected. And so we're going to be focusing on integrating these two systems so an eligibility technician and a clerical staff can be working and the information will be flowing back and forth, which will be helpful and time-saving. Asset verification, we currently verify assets for applications. It's a manual process. There's a checklist that we go through. Our staff will be working to automate that checklist. Instead of it being manual, it'll be converting to an automatic verification. And then finally, we are still required to mail out a lot of documents to clients. And so we get a lot of return mail. There's a solution with some equipment that will be able to scan envelopes, open it, scan the information, and upload and update the address. And that really will, again, help us with making sure that we have updated information. So you can see some operational efficiencies there. I've already talked about childcare. There's a new system that is phased approach rolling out. The same thing happened with our family nutrition, our WIC program. They had a new database that was launched internally and will be rolling out to our partners in the coming months. So you can see there's a significant amount of work happening within the division, within the project management team. It's a great, small but mighty team.
Senator Hughes.
I can see the clock ticking, Mr. Chair, but I can't help. I see the word automated on here, and I've been part of a national task force on cybersecurity and AI, and there's a lot of potential for AI to smooth the way, but there's also a lot of concern, and it's happened in other states where if it's used, like if eligibility technicians are using, there can be bias, something can be overlooked, somebody who should qualify or shouldn't, the wrong decision is made by AI, and these have meaningful impact on people's livelihoods. So anything where you're saying automated, is it actually AI? And do you have safeguards and human oversight? Are you doing any testing to make sure that biases and mistakes aren't occurring?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is a great question. And yes, there are some elements that include AI. They're limited and they are small. We are very cautious. And everything that we have implemented has been tested in a test environment by our eligibility technicians, looking and running them through various scenarios. And so we have been using automation to the degree of really connecting in databases. AI, there's different types of AI. It's very limited and very small, but they are not making any decisions. They're looking at the information. Does it exist? Does it not exist?
And follow up.
Senator Hughes.
I would say I would really encourage, I know this is a conversation in all 50 states, if you move for any decision making, I think there needs to be tremendous transparency. I think the public needs to be aware that that is happening, and I'd like to have a conversation offline because I know there's potential to help. It can be burdensome for sometimes employees to keep up with everything, so there definitely are could be benefits, but you have to be extremely cautious. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Commissioner.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And on slide 16, we're going to shift to the Division of Senior and Disability Services. The Division of Senior and Disability Services supports seniors, individuals with developmental disabilities, and vulnerable adults. I think one of the kind of most common areas that people are aware of include the work that they do to provide home and community-based waiver services to a number of Alaskans. So key accomplishments in 2024, recognizing the time, the division established direct support professional certification programs. This was a multi-year effort. It was done in coordination with the University of Alaska Anchorage, and the first cohort of 50 individuals received their certifications. The incoming cohort, the next group, is comprised of 60 individuals. And this is really an effort to kind of help support and stabilize that workforce by creating some professionalism and some certifications for the very valuable and important work that they provide. This was done in conjunction with stakeholders and included nearly 13 organizations across Alaska. The second item relates to what we talked about with complex care under our strengthening the behavioral health care system, and that's really making changes to some residential services to better serve individuals with specialized care. And again, that focuses on providing more flexibility for 2-to-1 staffing ratios, increased acuity rates, and new opportunities for residential options for older adolescents and youth. The last item on the accomplishment slide is one that, again, I know the division has worked very collaboratively with stakeholders and with the legislature to implement, which is using an NRI development, the development of an NRI assessment tool. From my perspective, this actually represents what will be a really important transformation for the home and community-based waiver system within the state of Alaska, because the development and the use of this tool will allow individuals to begin to implement self-directed services. So it will help establish kind of a budget based on an individual's need and really empower them to identify the services that will best fit their needs. It will also allow the division and the state to potentially serve more people more efficiently. So this is a multi-year effort. I think we are in year two of the effort. One note is that the division did work with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to receive 90% federal funding, 10% state funding for this tool. We are the first state to have received that type of funding for this service. So we're working very collaboratively to leverage our federal options as we move forward. We have procured a contractor to help us from a technical assistance perspective with this tool. And the next phase will be to issue a request for procurement for contractors to actually bring on board software to begin testing and ultimately implementation of the tool. So our focus next year will be completing that procurement process and bringing that contractor on board and designing the testing. The division is doing this very closely in alignment with stakeholder groups who are very, very eager to see this roll out. Looking at 2025, continuing on to that second item, the critical incident detection and trending system. This is a new system within the division that went live this year. We call it PulseLight, and this is really a system that will help the division kind of identify incidents or individuals that may be at risk that we do not have a full picture of when we're only looking at one system, but by looking at a combination of Medicaid claims and some of the information within the systems and the senior and disability services, we can identify incidents that right now may not necessarily be rising to our level of awareness. So an example of that would maybe be several individuals who receive care for falls that are all living at the same assisted living home. Those falls may not have been brought to the attention of the division from the assisted living home, but by looking at that kind of that holistic perspective using the data that's available, they can identify that there may be issues there that they need to take action on. So this is a way for us to improve our ability to support vulnerable adults in Alaska by utilizing more of the information that we have available for that. And then the last item that we're focusing on in 2025, and I should reframe that, one of the items we're focusing on in 2025 is really updating environmental modification services. So the legislature directed the division to increase the caps on environmental modification services. So these are things like wheelchair ramps or bars in the home, really these services that allow people to stay in their home for a longer period of time with appropriate modifications. So the cap last year was increased from $18,000 to $40,000. We are in the process of implementing regulations and kind of building out the requirements to leverage that increase and get the word out to people who may benefit from that.
For the record, Dr. Robert Lawrence, Chief Medical Officer, that brings us to our final checkpoint, which is a review of the operational update 225 focus for the Division of Public Health. And I think the best way to frame what's being done in the Division of Public Health is to recognize that in March of 2024, the Division of Public Health achieved national recognition or national public health accreditation under the Public Health Accreditation Board. This is a result of a multi-year robust look at the policies, procedures, as well as, most importantly, the quality improvement plan of this particular division. And so this looks out over the next 5 years and really guides a lot of what will be done. The important take-home point there is that the Division of Public Health is now recognized for its accountability, for its quality improvement, and for the services that it's providing to the communities of Alaska at this national standard. And so I'm just going to skip the rock sort of over the surface of these other items, but in your mind, you'll see how these fit into that accreditation and this commitment to quality improvement. We've commented earlier there on our operational update about how we're supporting communities in the opioid response. It's important to know that the National Opioid Settlement Funds is not the only financial support that we get. This last year, the Bureau of Justice Assistance gave us a $7 million grant that will also go in parallel with the other funding to help support the work of communities and those who are doing this work throughout Alaska. We are leveraging our community partnerships to maximize TB and syphilis testing capacity. This is a bit of a forewarning. This year, you will hear the numbers come out in terms of the number of TB cases that we've had this in 2024, as well as a rise in syphilis cases. I won't do the deep dive on that just now, but flag that for later. The important thing to know when you hear those numbers is that we're talking about infectious diseases with an opportunity to treat. So unlike when we're talking about numbers of deaths from, let's say, an opioid overdose, where there's not an opportunity to intervene, in this case, when we're talking about numbers of an infectious disease, every single case of syphilis, every single case of congenital syphilis or of TB represents an opportunity to intervene. And in every case that you hear those numbers, in your mind, know that those individuals are connected to care. As we switch over to the 2025 focus for the next year, as you already know, there are a tremendous number of people and number of sections within the Division of Public Health that are doing work really across the state. There'll be a focus in this next year on executing data integration and modernization, as you just heard in other divisions. This recognizes that the hard work being done by individuals on behalf of the health of our communities needs to be supported in terms of the ability to communicate. We still have parts of our, many of our sections are using fax machines. That needs to transition into the modern world where our communications really support people and supports our staff's ability to guard the health of Alaska. There'll be an initiative this year for a community health in Alaska roadmap. There's a recognition that public health in general needs to rise to the changing landscape in our communities. And so similar to what you heard earlier about the youth behavioral roadmap, there will be a similar statewide listening effort and initiative to find out what are the needs in each of our communities and then create a public health response plan or a community health plan that will meet those needs. There'll be an increase in the ability as a part of a pilot project to train, equip public health staff to be able to provide vital records. We were approached by a community organization and asked a what if question. What if public health staff who are already meeting individuals in certain places in the community had the ability, resources, training to print something as simple as, say, a birth certificate that's needed to apply for public assistance services or to get a driver's license? And we said that's a good idea. And so one of the things that you'll hear this year is efforts done in that particular pilot project. And then again, a part of just data modernization in general is a recognition that from a public health standpoint, the best way to ensure that there is treatment for disease is directly observed therapy. That requires someone to be directly there. But we now have the technology and would like to employ that, we hope this year, in a system that's called electronic directly observed therapy for individuals that have access to technology and who have those needs and can access those needs will be able to provide the service in that way. So that's the high-level overview of what's going on in the Division of Public Health. I'd like to turn it back over to our commissioner.
Thank you, Dr. Lawrence. With the, if there's no objection, I will extend this by 5 minutes. We have a few questions in the queue, starting with Senator Giesel.
Dr. Lawrence, could you give an update on how the public-private partnership to supply low-cost vaccines to Alaskans is operating? And secondarily, if the federal government rejects the efficacy of vaccines, how will that affect Alaska's program?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Giesel, we will follow up with you on the specifics, I think, and these are excellent questions. To the second question, I would say that in terms of federal recognition of the efficacy of vaccines, that does not, we are aware of, and we stay in regular contact, of course, with our federal partners, but that does not directly affect the recommendations that will come out of our Department of Health.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Vice Chair Giesel, excuse me. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a similar question. As I know, we've seen increased rates of whooping cough, and over the years we've talked about congenital syphilis and syphilis, and of course I have concerns about the increasing rates of HIV amongst our Alaska Native men in those communities. So I look forward to a deeper conversation about, as I hear you say, intervene, I'd like us to prevent. And we have the tools and resources and therapeutics to prevent. So I'm looking forward to conversations about that.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. I'll say for my part one comment. When you were talking about the community health roadmap and looking at sort of the public health challenges the state has faced, one thing I know that other states are starting to tackle now, a sort of new thing, is the sort of explosion on online sports gambling. And this actually is starting to be treated like a public health issue in other states because it is driving suicide, it's driving bankruptcy, and it's actually you can track it, actually. I mean, it's because it has exploded so recently. And so obviously not something we're tackle here today, but thinking of the sort of rise of that industry as having at least some ancillary health impacts, I'd like that to be sort of part of that public health discussion. Senator Hughes.
Thank you. And I will add on to that. We need to be watching, too, the use of bots where youth get attached to them. There was an incident of a suicide where the bot was encouraging the youth. So that's another thing we need to be watching. I did have a question because I brought up the shortage of mental health providers that are in my community. And in my life before being in this building, serving my district in Alaska, I worked. It was actually with a House representative from many years ago from Bethel, Representative Heron, and it was on a health care professionals loan repayment program that would complement the National Health Service Corps loan repayment program. And it is on the books. I don't know that it's been funded in those early years some. I think it's just sitting there. But if we have a shortage of mental health providers, I'm not sure if that category would be covered, but I think it should be, and we need to think about, is that a way we can help get these providers, especially now that the exciting opportunity to have the behavioral health community clinics, there's going to be needs. But again, as I said before, if there's a shortage in my urban area, I'm sure there are in the more remote areas, and it's going to be an ongoing need. And like you said, this is a conversation in all 50 states. So training our own is probably the best bet. So I hope you would reconsider, look at that to see, do we need to add mental health type providers to it? Is that something that we could perhaps look at finding some funding, which I know is going to be tough. But I'm really particularly concerned about our youth because I'm hearing the mental health crisis among our youth is really very concerning. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Commissioner, we're almost out of time. Do you have any closing comments?
I do, yeah. I will answer Senator Hughes's question and then quick closing comments. SHARP 3 does include behavioral health, and it is going really well, and we can follow up with a report to show you all of the different occupations that are taking advantage of SHARP 1 and SHARP 3. I really appreciate the opportunity to just present before the Senate House Committee all of the work that has been accomplished over the past 2 years, specifically the last year, and then what is to come over the next year to 2 years. I think, again, it's a lot of listening. And now you're going to start to see a lot of things being implemented because we have the staff and the resources to do a lot of this work before us. So thank you for your time, and we're open to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I don't see any. So I think We're done. Thank you so much for a great presentation and for the work of you, Commissioner Hedberg, and your team. With that, are there any closing questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, January 28th at 3:30 p.m. The time is now 5:05, and this hearing is adjourned.